The Church of God, the Eternal, presents the 18th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, December 13th, 2025.
Well, we're going to pick up this, what will turn out to be a long series covering the survey of the books of Samuel. This will now be the 18th message in the series. We've made it through not all, but the majority of the 17th chapter last time, which, as you will recall, was the fateful story of David and Goliath. So we saw the majority of the run-up in chapter 17, plus the actual confrontation where God gave this young whippersnapper upstart shepherd boy this incredible victory over this champion Philistine soldier with the sling of one river stone that killed him. And so if you recall now, we completed right through the defeat of Goliath, the total upheaval within the army of the Philistines, who turned and ran and fled. The Israelite army pursued them, killed many of them, and then basically took all of the loot from their camp. And so now we're going to pick it up. Well, before we actually get in to the very end verses of chapter 17 where we left off, I thought it was a good time to reemphasize the fact of why I'm doing this whole series, and I've said it, but I'm going to keep repeating it. The reason I wanted to cover 1 and 2 Samuel is because I think the story of the life of King David is incredibly valuable and instructive, and based not just because they're cool stories, like David and Goliath. More so is the analysis of the orientation of mind in David, even from a youth, and the way he looked at things, the way he evaluated things compared to people around him. So we already saw that in the last message. When he shows up on the scene now where the army's been camped out for over 40 days, and Goliath is twice a day has been taunting the army of Israel. And here's young David as a teenager who comes in and says, "What?" You know, he saw it as an absolute affront to the living God. The rest of the Israelites were all very physical and materialistic in mind. They were thinking about themselves, about King Saul, their role, you know, in a physical army. David looked at this as an affront to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And his zeal and his response showed that very flavor, very different than the people around him, including his brothers. So we saw that element of it, but you're going to see that in the entire story of the life of King David. This is just the very, very beginning of it. But my intent is to try to point out what I believe is every critical incident, I'll call it that, through the storyline that we're going to read through 1 and 2 Samuel, which shows you this difference in the way that David thinks and processes events, especially under pressure. The basis on which he made decisions versus what most people would do. And he surprised a whole lot of people because he had, you know, his underlings, you know, when we get into his time as a general and as king, and you've got his entourage, if you will, of people who think they know him and think they know what he wants. And they are wrong, showing that they didn't really understand at all what was most important to him because of the mistakes that they would make. So we're going to go through and highlight all of those things that really made David different than other people, which is why God called him a man after his own heart. And before getting into the very end of chapter 1 Samuel 17, I want to turn instead to Psalm 144. Recall now that David wrote a lot of the Psalms in the book of Psalms. Now, what I wanted to do is to say now, since David wrote these Psalms and they had direct application to events in his life, I wondered if there was one that correlated more so to this event with his defeat of Goliath. And there is no direct, there's, you know, there's, An example of one that is keyed very specifically would be Psalm 51. Psalm 51, he wrote in the aftermath of his great sin with Bathsheba and the murder of her husband, Uriah the Hittite. Okay, so there's a direct correlation of one. And when we get way down the road, we'll cover that. My goal, if I don't forget it, is to try to relate back and read a number of the Psalms of David along the storyline. But I will tell you from the beginning that I can't, I have to find out, do the scholars say there's any direct correlation of certain things? And no, it's all a lot of speculation among the scholars. So I'm not here to tell you that I can put one with another. But Psalm 141 is one that a lot of scholars believe tells elements that David chose to tell concerning Goliath. Now, we have to read between the lines, but I think it's worth reading verses 1 through 10 here. Psalm 144, verse 1, a psalm of David. Blessed be the Eternal, my strength, which teacheth my hands to war and my fingers to fight. And I'm thinking, okay, remember, he used a sling to defeat Goliath, which absolutely included his expertise with the fingers, because it's all in the release of that sling in order to throw an accurate stone. So you be the judge if you think this is a direct reference in his mind under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, which teaches my hands to war and my fingers to fight. My goodness and my fortress, referring to God, and I'll just make the off-the-cuff comment here. Here's a direct reference using the term my goodness. And what is it? It's a reference to God. Remember, that's one of those oaths that is very common in our language. And there's some of you, my dear friends, or the hearing of my voice, who have used this and do it, you say it automatically, it comes out of your mouth, oh my goodness. It is taking God's name in vain. And I know it's very, very, very hard to break a habit, but my goodness is just another name for saying my God. So if you wouldn't say my God, you shouldn't say my goodness either, unless you intend to refer to God like David is doing here. Now, if it's your direct intention to use the name of God with purpose, then absolutely. But don't do it without thinking, because now you're using the name of God in a vain way, in an unthinking way. But David says, my goodness, referring to God, and my fortress, my high tower, and my deliverer, my shield, and he in whom I trust. Did David go out on the battlefield with Goliath with a shield? Nope. He was absolutely exposed. No armor, no weapons except for a sling and a staff. And yet, he did it in confidence, believed that God literally was acting as a shield, a piece of defensive armor for him. Who subdueth my people under me. That's interesting. What's he talking about? And by the way, I also tried to look up and find out, are the Psalms of David like written in order by numbers? No. So we can't even tell which one. This was 144. And scholars think it was likely written later in his life, but reminiscing back toward maybe the events from his youth and this particular battle with Goliath. Maybe so, maybe not. But one of the aftermaths of this battle with Goliath was what? Well, this is what catapulted him into the public eye within Israel. Saul is, and we're going to read that entire story to come. And what was God doing in the midst of this? Literally elevating David in the minds of the people to ultimately put him on the throne of Israel. So the people he's referring to when he says, my people, are the people of Israel. They're God's people. And yet David is giving God credit here for the fact that he rose to become king. When who was he? A nobody, an absolute nobody. Who, referring to God, subdueth my people under me. He's the one that elevated David to become king over the nation. Verse 3, the eternal, what is man that thou taketh knowledge of him, or the son of man that thou makest account of him? Man is like to vanity. His days are as a shadow that passes away. He's expressing a humble grateful orientation, not counting himself as worthy of any great honor, respect, elevation. He puts himself in the role of a supplicant to God, giving God all of the credit, which is, makes all the difference. Verse 5, bow thy heavens, O eternal, and come down. Touch the mountains, and they shall smoke. Who has the power? Who is exerting his will in the kingdoms of men? It's God. Verse 6, cast forth lightning and scatter them. Shoot out thine arrows and destroy them. Who is, in essence, he's saying, was given the credit for this defeat of the Philistines? David was the instrument, but David rightly understands it was not by his power or even his luck. It was by the will of God. Verse 7, send thine hand from above, rid me and deliver me out of great waters from the hand of strange children. Now, this might apply not just to this initial battle with Goliath, but David's entire life, as we're going to find out, was fraught with war and with battle. He spent the majority of his entire lifetime fighting as a warrior in the service of God. But there's a reason, as we're going to find out when we get to it, that God didn't let him build the temple. And God called David, in hindsight, a bloody man. Yeah, but he was doing exactly what God told him to do. To fight when he told him to fight, and to go or not to go. But the role that David played in the very overall plan of God was one of a warrior. And by the way, he paid great prices because of that. But he did it by the will of God. David says, rid me and deliver me out of the great waters from the hand of strange children, whose mouth speaketh vanity. Isn't that what Goliath did? Didn't Goliath come out twice a day, morning and evening, spouting all of this stuff, belittling the army of Israel and King Saul, challenging them to send out somebody who was worthy to fight him in a duel one-on-one. So Goliath, among many later enemies of David, then certainly fit this. Whose mouth speaks vanity, and their right hand is a right hand of falsehood. Verse 9, David says, I will sing a new song unto thee, O God. Upon a psaltery and an instrument of 10 strings will I sing praises unto thee, referring to the very harp or lyre that he was adept at playing. Verse 10, it is he that giveth salvation unto kings. It's not by luck, it's not by chance, and it's not by cunning, taking advantage of an opportunity, being in the right place at the right time, that elevates a king onto the throne. It's God who, according to his purpose, elevates a man into a particular role. It is he that giveth salvation unto kings, who delivereth David his servant from the hurtful sword. Goliath absolutely intended to cut David down with his great sword, and that's what he said he was going to do. And said he was going to leave his carcass for the birds. That's not what happened, as we read last time. So now let's get into 1 Samuel 17, verse 55. We left off after verse 54. Now we get into this, one of those difficult passages, and we're going to spend a little time. By the way, if I get through half of this chapter, of chapter 18, we'll be doing well today. This is where we end up slowing down. I can't keep one chapter per sermon. I think the material is valuable, so I definitely want you to have the benefit of it. So here is where we find out that it appears that Saul and even his general, Abner, don't know who David is. And this is one of those perplexing things that has to do with trying to sort out the actual timing of these events in the storyline. Verse 55, when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, he said unto Abner, the captain of the host, Abner, whose son is this youth? So it looks like Saul had no clue. But was it just Saul? Because I'm going to give you several scholarly explanations for this. See if any of them make sense to you or not. But he says, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, well, don't you remember? He's the one that we brought to court and he played the harp for you. Abner didn't say that. If Saul was mentally defective because of this demon spirit, then I would say so was Abner. So that makes no sense to me. And Abner said, "As thy soul liveth, O king, I cannot tell. I don't know who this kid is." So what's going on? Verse 56, "And the king said, Inquire thou whose son the stripling is." I didn't look it up, but I'm assuming this is the equivalent of us saying, who's this young whippersnapper? Who's this stripling? Verse 57, "And as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine," just get a mental picture of this, "he's killed this giant. No one thought this was going to happen. He ran upon the dead body, pulled out the giant's sword from his scabbard, and then used it to hack his head off his body. And if you think that would be an easy thing to do through a spine and through all the connective tissue, think again. I don't know how many strokes it would have taken him, you know, to do it, or you or me to do it. But that would have been a bloody, consider that the first bloody feat of young David, other than killing a lion and a bear. But this is his first human kill, if you will, and cutting off the head. The king said, "Inquire thou whose son the stripling is." And David, as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him, meaning David, and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. Now that's quite an introduction. Showing up before the king, all bloody yourself, holding probably by the hair of this giant, you know, this mutilated head. Verse 58, "And Saul said to him, Whose son art thou, thou young man? And David answered, I am the son of thy servant, Jesse the Bethlehemite." So what's going on here? Why does Saul and Abner both seem like they've never met him before or crossed his path? When we already read, remember back, hold your finger there and turn back to chapter 16, verse 18. We read this a couple of sermons ago. Remember, Saul is now being plagued by this demon spirit that comes and goes upon him and puts him in this dark mood. The verse 18 in chapter 16 says, "Then answered one of the servants and said, Behold, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite, that is cunning in playing, and a mighty valiant man, and a man of war, and prudent in matters, and a comely person, and the Eternal is with him." Remember I told you like how he's coming off the farm, guarding sheep, and how is it this person in the court of Saul is saying he's aware of this kid who has this reputation as a mighty man, which is what made me think, wait a minute, maybe this storyline's out of order. I don't think it is. And I'll retell you why momentarily. But anyway, drop down to verse 21 of chapter 16. "And David came to Saul and stood before him, and he, Saul, loved him," David. Saul loved David greatly. "And he became his armor bearer. And Saul sent to Jesse, saying, Let David, I pray thee, stand before me, for he hath found favor in my sight." So how do the scholars answer this dichotomy, this seeming contradiction of why David had already spent time in the court of the king, playing his harp? And my point is, it says Saul loved him greatly. He wasn't just some, you know, nondescript courtier coming and going. It says he loved him greatly, made him his armor bearer. So some scholars say, number one, Saul was mentally impaired from the evil spirit and didn't remember David. In other words, Saul was out of it mentally. He was taken over by this demon, therefore he was like insane. I absolutely do not believe that is true. Because if it is true, then everything that Saul did from here on out is not his fault. The whole rest of the storyline in dealing with David up until Saul's death on the battlefield means Saul was not in his right mind and cannot be held accountable. I do not believe that is true. I believe that Saul had his right mind, was held by God responsible for the decisions that he made. He wasn't just some insane or, you know, had dementia or something like that. I do not think that fits the storyline or the lessons that God intended for us to get out of the books of 1 Samuel at all. But some scholars say, well, he just didn't remember him at all because he was out of it mentally. The second category of scholarly answers says that, well, David, it's just that David was of low importance previously. Saul and Abner simply didn't retain details about a low-status shepherd boy amid wartime chaos. So he was in the court, but Saul wasn't really aware of him. Well, then why does it say he loved him greatly and made him his armor bearer? That explanation doesn't match for me, not at all. Third category was the one I was most attracted to at first, which is to say that the storyline is not in sequential order. That the Goliath episode we just read about, topically in order of when it happened, actually happened before David's full integration as an armor bearer and a courtier. Meaning that literally was the first time Saul and Abner ever saw him. And that what we saw in chapter 16 was kind of fast-forwarding and telling something after. And then chapter 17, David and Goliath kind of inserted a storyline that was in between. But I have a problem with that too. And specifically because of 1 Samuel 17, verse 15 and 16. Remember that one. Verse 15 and 16 of chapter 17 says, David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And the Philistine drew near, verse 16, morning and evening, and presented himself 40 days. So this says that David was with Saul, and then David went home at the very same time that the Philistines arrayed themselves across the valley, and Goliath comes on the scene. So if the very first time that David was introduced to Saul and Abner was after he defeated Goliath and was holding his head in his hand, and then he went with Saul back to the court and began for the first time to play his harp to soothe, you know, the king and all of that, then this doesn't make sense. Because as we're going to read, after David slays Goliath, he never goes home. We're going to see it. Saul has him come with him back to Gibeah, to his court. So how do you, if it wasn't for verse 15, I could make an argument to say, you know, here's literally as a flashback to in David and Goliath, and it happened. But how to understand, you know, the text in chapter 18 to say that David already had a reputation as a valiant man when he hadn't done anything militarily yet? I don't know. But the fourth category of the explanation for this, why did Saul and Abner not seem to know David in what we just read here at the end of chapter 17? And I like this one the best. The explanation says that Saul's question to Abner, who is this kid, was not about not knowing him personally. It was about fulfilling Saul's promise made to the champion back in verse 25. Remember, Saul made promise, the army soldiers told David when he showed up with the food for his brothers. And they said, the king has promised a reward to anybody who can slay the giant. What's he going to get? One, he gets to marry a princess. He gets a lot of money. And his family gets to be exempt from the king's taxes. A three-part reward was going to be given to the champion. So is it possible? This is still all speculation. Is it possible now that young David has slain this giant that Saul is thinking in terms of not the young shepherd boy who became his harpist? He's seeing David in a totally different light. And now he's looking at him from the standpoint of ultimately potentially becoming part of his family. Because part of Saul's promise was that the champion who kills the giant gets to marry one of his daughters. Is Saul really saying, nah, I never met this guy, I don't know who this kid is? It's more like, wait a minute, who is this kid really, and what's his family background? If he's got to entertain the possibility of having marry in to the royal family, what's his real background? Yes, I mean, he appeared to know that his father's name was Jesse, But maybe now he's asking, who is this Jesse, the Bethlehemite? And what's his real family background? Because now it matters, because this is not just a shepherd boy anymore. This is a champion of Israel. So of all the explanations, I guess I like that one the best. I still don't propose to you that we have a clear way to resolve everything, but it's one way that, at least in my mind, I can get behind. Now we're into chapter 18. Chapter 18, and we find at the very outset, introduces a new alliance between Jonathan and David. Verse 1 of chapter 18 says, "It came to pass when he had made an end to speaking unto Saul," David answers Saul's question, "that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul." Jonathan, in essence, latched on to young David and adopted him as a brother, which is absolutely amazing when you think about all the dynamics that are involved in this. Jonathan is the oldest son of the king. He is heir apparent when his father dies to be king of Israel. And yet here now is the heir who has every reason to be jealous of David. If anybody had reason to be jealous of David, it would be Jonathan. And instead of being jealous of him, he embraces him as a brother, as a fast friend. So what are the dynamics that are involved in that? I will advance to you the most likely answer for that is the fact that Jonathan's real love was for Israel as a nation under God. And that Jonathan recognized God's favor and support through young David. Jonathan, unlike his father Saul, as we're going to see as the story unfolds, Saul fights David, and the whole time he's fighting God. Jonathan recognizes it for what it is. Is it possible, because we don't see any, God chooses not to make any comment concerning the backstory or the motivation of Jonathan, other than the interaction that he has in future months and years with David? If I'm trying to read between the lines and create a backstory, I would say, if you were in a position, regardless of who you were physically, but a nation or a group that you loved, and you saw somebody stand up and demonstrate the power of God's help to make that individual a miraculous servant, and you loved the same things that God loved, would you embrace his champion? That seems to be what Jonathan did. They became fast friends. Verse 2, "And Saul took him that day." At this point, Saul loves David too. I mean, come on. This is the kid who just defeated your great enemy, sent your entire, the Philistine army, your enemy, running. You just had this massive victory as a king. And you have this young stripling, this upstart, to thank for it. Oh, man. I mean, what it is to have someone like that. "Saul took him that day and would let him go no more home to his father's house." That was the one I was referencing to you. So after this event, David never went home, which is going to make it hard for us to change the order of the events. And this, by the way, is probably why, was it verse 54 of the last chapter, the last one we read last time, when it said that David... let's just read it. Chapter 17, 54, "David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem." So the fact that David did not go home from the battle, and we went through the geography of where David's home in Bethlehem was compared to the battle site, and where Gibeah was, which is the site of the king's throne. So David didn't go home, which is why it would put him on a path to pass by the gates of Jerusalem. It said David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put the armor in his tent. So that's likely the correct order. David never went home after the battle. Verse 3, back in chapter 18, Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul, and Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David and his garments, even to his sword and to his bow and to his girdle. All right, what's involved in this? This is talking about the royal effects of a prince. The robe that we're talking about, this isn't talking about his bathrobe. This is talking about a royal robe of the heir apparent to the throne. It's not an everyday cloak. In the Old Testament, the robe is almost always a princely or royal garment, often richly decorated and reaching to the ankles or the feet. By giving David his own royal robe, Jonathan is symbolically transferring the rights and insignia of the heir apparent to David. Now, it doesn't say Saul was there when this took place, but he must know about it. And I don't know, I'm trying to write a backstory on this event too. Remember, David shows up. He's not a warrior. He doesn't have any clothing, let alone armaments of a warrior. And yet now Saul is embracing him in his court and going to promote him as a general in his army, as we're going to find out. David doesn't have anything of his own. He's a poor shepherd boy. He thought he was just going to take food to his brothers and then go back home. All of a sudden, his life's been totally upended, and now he's not going home again. This kid doesn't have any money or has very little. He has very little of anything. Jonathan understands this kid is important in the plan of God. He recognizes it apparently before anybody else. Probably inspired by God to recognize that this is going to be the real king that's going to succeed his own father. And so it makes perfect sense to me that Jonathan would say, you know what, man, you can't walk around like that. You need some real clothes to go with your new station in life. Here, have mine. At least that's the way I make it up in my head. What about the garments that are listed here? The Hebrew word behind it implies a tunic and or armor. So most modern scholars understand that it probably includes a fitted military tunic worn under the armor, essentially the equivalent of a prince's dress uniform. That's what we're talking about. What about the sword, the bow, and it says a girdle, which means a belt. These are the personal sidearms of the crown prince. This belt or girdle is the military sash that held the sword. This was as close as one could come, short of public coronation, to saying the kingdom is no longer mine, it belongs to you. Coming from the current heir, who is in essence ceding that position and giving it to another. So this is literally is a phenomenal event in history. And I think it's very, very easy to underappreciate the actions of Jonathan as God inspired him now to become the friend and the confederate of David. And he's going to need him, by the way, with the events that are going to transpire. Verse 6 of chapter 18, and it came to pass as... I've skipped verse 5. Can't do that. Verse 5 is very important. 1 Samuel 18, verse 5, David went out whithersoever Saul sent him and behaved himself wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war. Now, he's just a teenager. Okay, he's had this one event where he kills the giant. And now Saul elevates him basically as a company commander. Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. This is a big deal. What happens if you've got a favorite of the king or the boss who likes him and thinks he's really capable, and he elevates him into a position of responsibility, but the other people are going, we ain't going along with this. Who is this young kid? Who does he think he is? What has he got to offer us? He's got no experience. What this tells you is David, though he has age against him, he has experience against him. People will naturally look at him and look down upon him for his lack of maturity and experience. And yet, he earns quickly the respect of all. Not only of the common people, that's the significant thing about this. This isn't just he earns the respect of one group, like the commoners like him, but the aristocrats all look down on him. No, the courtiers under Saul, the movers and the shakers, the elites and the power brokers under the king, they also loved David. He gained the respect of all of them, the higher echelons as well as the commoners. That's just what this says. He was accepted in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. These servants, this is not talking about the maids and the butlers in a palace. You're talking about the ones like Abner and all of the generals and all of the now members of the court who helped Saul literally run the government. And David endeared himself to all of them. What was it that this kid had going for him besides God's favor? There must have been actions. There must have been things that he said, things that he did, things that he didn't say and didn't do that actually created this reputation that he gained quickly with the people that he interfaced with. Now, verse 6 and 7, and now we have another conundrum. We have another difficulty. We'll spend a little time on it. But I'll read verse 6 and 7 first, and then we'll analyze. It came to pass as they came, whatever that means, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tabrets, with joy, with instruments of music. Verse 7, and the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Okay, now we got drama because of what this is going to do in the mind of Saul. The question is, when did this happen? Because if chapter 18 is written in sequential order of events, verse 5 says, as we just read, that when they first came back from this battle with the Philistines, that Saul elevated David and put him over soldiers, and that there was time for David to build this reputation with the people and the court officers. And then verse 6 and 7, which implies sometime afterward, weeks, maybe months, that this event happens with this parade. I'm going to call it a parade in Saul's honor, where these women now sing and dance and sing this little ditty, which upsets Saul. But what did we read in verse 6? It came to pass as they came when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine. The first time I looked up was, is this reference to the Philistine talking about Goliath, or is it talking about, or could it be interpreted as other Philistines that like David battled against in the aftermath? Like he was coming back from one of these forays where Saul sent him out with a command, and he came back against the slaughter of more Philistines. That's not what it seems to say. This is a specific reference, and the scholars all agree the Philistine means Goliath. It's talking about the big Philistine. So timing-wise, it appears that this event with the singers who caused Saul to be jealous, as we're going to read, happened right after the battle as they were coming home back to Gibeah. Is that true? I think there's problems with that. But that's one plausible thing we have to consider. And then the women came out. But if that's true, what does that mean? It means that Saul's jealousy of David happened immediately. As they were coming back, marching back from the battlefield, coming back to his headquarters, and immediately this event happened with these women as they were marching back, coming out and singing this song, which upset Saul and caused him to be jealous of David, and yet It says Saul wanted David and elevated him and gave him. Okay, it's possible. And we're going to see that his jealousy, Saul's jealousy, does not preclude him from giving favor to David. The question is, did it happen really immediately? Some scholars say so. They claim that this parade happened as they were returning from the battle with Goliath, not many or some days later. I say not necessarily. To me, it doesn't fit. Let's keep reading and then we'll do a little bit more analysis. Verse 8, Saul was very wroth when he heard this little song. And the saying displeased him, and he said, "They've ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they've ascribed thousands. And what can he have more but the kingdom?" Meaning, what else does this young kid aspire to have that he doesn't already have, except my very throne? What else does this kid lack except becoming king in my place? Verse 9, and Saul eyed David from that day and forward. Was it from the day after the battle when they were marching back? And from that day forward, this jealousy in Saul was already ignited? Maybe so, maybe not. My question is, would Saul have assigned armies to a teenager if he was already jealous from the outset? Maybe so, maybe not. Here's where I'm going to read a passage out of the Radio Church of God Bible story, just to show you how they flowered up the storyline. This is still just speculation, but this is from the Bible Story, Volume 6, pages 67 to 69, under the subheading, A Hero's Acclaim. Here's what it said. Quote, "I salute you, David," Saul exclaimed. "I should like to have you remain here with me and my officers so that you can train to become an accomplished soldier." David thanked Saul, at the same time wondering how Saul could have forgotten the weeks David had spent with him as a musician and an armor bearer. Not wishing to embarrass Saul, David refrained from mentioning these things to him. I've already given you my take, differing opinion on that. Continuing, "One of the first matters," the Bible story says, "one of the first matters David took care of that day was to send a message to Jesse, his father, informing him that he was safe and would be staying with Saul for a time. In the days that followed, David and Saul's son Jonathan became close friends. Jonathan honored David by presenting him with some of his costly military clothing and weapons. David was so useful and well-liked by all that Saul made him an officer of high rank in his army. That didn't mean he was to start out by commanding men in battle, but that he had other duties of a lighter nature that nevertheless afforded him great respect, and he would be quickly trained to lead troops in battle. Then, or thereafter," is the implication in this version of the story, "then an incident took place that destroyed Saul's friendliness toward David. It was part of God's plan to eventually move David into power as king of Israel. Days were required for news of the Philistines' defeat to spread over all Israel. The people were so happily excited that some of the city sent to Gibeah groups of young women trained as dancers, singers, and musicians to praise the Israelite army for its victory." So this takes the storyline that it took a number of days for the word to spread about this great victory over the Philistines and the death of Goliath and all of that. And then they put together representative to send to the capital city of Gibeah to honor Saul and the army. "When it was announced," it says, "that the girls were coming to parade past Saul's royal quarters, crowds gathered along the street. Saul and his officers, including David and Jonathan, waited on the balcony of the building while thousands of troops stood by at attention nearby. Band after band of young women singing loudly, banging tambourines, plucking lyres, and blowing horns moved nimbly down the street past the crowds in Saul's balcony. Some marched, some danced, and others rode on animals as they played. They shouted tributes to the troops and officers and sang songs that were composed to direct enthusiastic esteem to the victorious warriors. Saul and his men were very pleased by this animated demonstration. Then, toward the end of the parade, came an especially vocal group of singers whose song was worded rather carelessly. Quote, "Our thanks to Saul, our mighty king, for facing thousands one cannot count. But David's feat was a greater thing, like facing 10 times that amount." Well, there's an anglicized version of the poem. It goes on to say, "The bystanders, having heard so much of David's heroism, broke into wild applause. Saul's expression of pleasure abruptly melted away to make way for a scowl he couldn't hide. He glanced darkly at David, who was so embarrassed by the singers that he turned away from the balcony. Saul quickly strode off to his quarters." That was a most disloyal display, Saul muttered to himself as he paced irritably back and forth in a private room. The crowd applauded David's name more than mine. Surely it isn't possible that this young upstart is the one Samuel predicted would take the leadership of Israel from me. Unquote. Okay, so there's your fictionalized version. But again, so the church had to take a position too. What do you think the real order of the events was? So I just think this matches better from the idea that the jealousy did not start from day one. It might have been just a few days hence when the cities of Israel sent these representatives and did this parade, but that the initial, I see it in my mind when I think about the story, that there were at least a number of days in which Saul was genuinely happy to have young David as a member of the court and actually lauding him for his role as a champion in Israel before this event happened days or maybe even some weeks later. But anyway, back to chapter 18, verse 10. "And it came to pass on the morrow." So whenever this parade happened, whether it was day one as they were marching back to the capital city, or whether it was days or weeks later, after this event with the parade and Saul hearing these women sing this song, which gave more tribute to David than to Saul, the next day, everything else unfolded. Verse 10, "It came to pass on the morrow that the evil spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied in the midst of the house. And David played with his hand as at other times, and there was a javelin in Saul's hand." Okay, what does this tell us? One, I don't know why Saul had a javelin in his hand. There's some scholars who think that he used a javelin kind of like a scepter while he was sitting on the throne. It's all speculation. But what about this saying that Saul prophesied in the midst, because we think of prophecy as speaking by the inspiration of God, either to reveal something about the future or at least speak in an inspired manner, as we've talked about before. One other example I'll use, no, and God is not inspiring Saul like he did in the early days when Saul was young and humble and fulfilling the will of God. We went through those stories in the early part of the account where he did prophesy. Remember, and the people said, "Is Saul now become one of the prophets?" Because he spoke in an inspired manner with the prophets, with the Levites. This is a different kind of prophesying. Here's one example. Have you turn over to 1 Kings 18, verse 28. 1 Kings 18:28, which is the story of Elijah and his showdown with the 400 priests of Baal on the top of Mount Carmel. When under Ahab and Jezebel, basically they've gotten rid of all of God's true ministers and prophets and installed these Baal worshipers. And so Elijah challenges them. Now let's find out who's really the servant of the one true God. And so they have this big event that happens on the top of Mount Carmel. Well, all day long, these prophets of Baal are doing all their mumbo jumbo trying to get their God to show them a manifestation of power. And that's what we want to look at in verse 28. And they, these prophets of Baal, cried aloud and cut themselves after their manner with knives and lancets till the blood gushed out upon them. What are they doing at the same time? They're in this frenzy, cutting themselves, trying to summon the power of their God. Verse 29, "And it came to pass when midday was past," they've been doing this all morning, now we're into the afternoon, "and they prophesied until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice." So this is the prophets of Baal are prophesying. This means false prophesying. That there was neither voice nor any to answer nor any that regarded. And so you know the story. Elijah comes on the scene after they do all their stuff and get no answer from their God. He builds a fire, douses it with water just to show that it's almost impossible for that thing to light on fire. And then God sends, with one request to God, God sends this lightning bolt and sets the whole thing on fire and burns up all the prophets of Baal. A really, really cool thing in history. But anyway, this I just wanted to point, this is another reference similar to, in the wording, to that with Saul prophesying. Very similar to the very acts of hundreds of years later with these prophets of Baal and their prophesying. Saul is being inspired by a demon. Okay, but what is this? He's speaking falsehoods in the name of, you know, Satan. Back to chapter 1 Samuel 18. Actually, the New Living Translation, which I think is pretty accurate here, because if you look at the meaning of the Hebrew words behind it, the New Living Translation says he began to rave madly in his house like a madman. And that is a fitting explanation for prophesying in this state. And I would say that's what those prophets of Baal and Mount Carmel were doing too. They were raving like madmen, cutting themselves and all of this. So Saul was absolutely being overtaken by this demon spirit. Was he insane at this moment? Oh, very likely. That does not mean he lived in a continual, perpetual state of insanity. Remember, this is a demon that would come and go, afflict him, and then recede. He had many times of lucidity. Okay, then verse 11. Then Saul cast the javelin. So David's there like he did in the days of old to play the harp and to soothe them, and it used to work. The problem is now Saul is afflicted by jealousy toward David, which opens this door for this demon now to mess with him and to agitate him. And now David is the one who's going to come in and play his harp to try and soothe him? That ain't going to work. He's the absolute object of Saul's wrath. Saul cast the javelin, for he said, I will smite David even to the wall with it. And David avoided out of his presence, and it says here not just once but twice. So apparently, and this is what the scholars say, it's like he threw the javelin once, David had to dodge it, now he's running, Saul runs, picks up the javelin, throws him at him again before he could get out of the chamber. So he had to dodge twice to avoid getting killed by the king. So on the timing, again, I ask, did this happen the day after the defeat of Goliath, as a lot of scholars think? Or did this happen some days or weeks down the line? If I have to guess, I think some days or weeks down the line. I think there was a honeymoon period where Saul thought David was the greatest thing. And then this event happened and it changed everything. But that's just my interpretation. All right, verse 12. If it's true this happened the day after, then we're going to look at verses 12 through 16 differently. 12 through 16 provides you some more details about the assignment of David's military duties. Verse 12, Saul was afraid of David because the Eternal was with him. Did Saul recognize the source of David's strength and power? Yep. Saul was afraid of David because the Eternal was with him and was departed from Saul. Saul understood lucidly what was going on. Verse 13, therefore, because Saul said, okay, God, I'm sorry. I know I blew it. I can't be king anymore. You've already said my dynasty is not going to happen. This appears to be the guy you want on the throne in place of me. Okay, I submit to your will. No, that's not what he did. Therefore, Saul removed him, David, from him. He took David out of his presence at court. He wanted to get David away from him personally. and made him his captain over 1,000. Now we find out he literally is a commander over 1,000 soldiers. And he, David, went out and came in before the people. So now over this troop of 1,000, he's going out, engaging in battles with the enemy and coming back. And along the way, he's creating this reputation for himself among the people as well as the officers of the court. Verse 14, and David behaved himself wisely in all his ways, and the Eternal was with him. Verse 15, wherefore, when Saul saw that he, David, behaved himself very wisely, Saul saw the fruit of it by what David was doing. He was hoping this young kid would fall on his face and either get killed or show himself to be inexperienced and lose the support of the people. That's what Saul wanted to happen, but the opposite happened. When Saul saw that David behaved himself very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. He was a man of the people. And he didn't sequester himself away like, oh, I'm above you now. He was with the people. He was on their level. And they respected him. I think it's interesting, too, this reference to Israel and Judah. Weren't they all one nation? Why didn't it just say, and all of Israel? Why did it say all Israel and Judah? Because Judah is a part of the nation of Israel. Already, it appears God is making a distinction between what would ultimately become, after the death of David and Solomon, a division between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. They're all one nation now under one king at this time. I get the inference that there's still a difference in thinking, maybe associated with these tribes and their genetics. Remember, all of these 12 tribes came out of 4 different mothers. The majority, 6 of the 12, were from the true wife of Jacob, who was Leah. She wasn't the beloved one, but she was his legal wife in the eyes of God. The beloved one of Jacob was the second one he married, which was Rachel. Well, who were the children of Rachel? Joseph and Benjamin, meaning the 2 sons of Joseph, which were Ephraim and Manasseh, who now were tribes. So by nature, you had the children of Rachel, who included Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. And who is Saul? What tribe did Saul come out of? Benjamin. All right, now where does Judah? Now David is from the tribe of Judah, who is actually one of the 6 sons of Leah. Just of interest, her sons included Judah, Levi, Reuben, and Simeon. Remember, Simeon and Levi were the ones from Genesis 34 who killed all of the men of Shechem by tricking them into being circumcised and then slaughtering them. Reuben had his problems. Judah had a lot of problems. So anyway, this is a sordid bunch. But is there a difference perhaps genetically in the way these people think by genetics coming out of, because they all have the same father, but there was a division in the mothers? I don't know. But God is already referring them in this early days as Israel and Judah, as if they're 2 different groups. And what you're going to see, and I'm telling you that because as we get in later into the storyline, we find that when David goes on the run, who is it that's going to help him? In essence, against Saul. Who supports Saul and who supports David? Primarily, it's Judah. It's the ones from his own tribe and others, by the way. We'll talk about that. But this division is already starting to raise its head as far as what's going to trigger people to support one versus the other. Either Saul and his dynasty or David. My next question to end this today. David has this great acclaim. He's this teenager with no experience. He has this one great defeat of a giant with a sling, but now Saul promotes him into this basically a generalship over 1,000 soldiers, and he's going out. What would a young man without experience, especially military experience, have to do to earn the respect of the people? See, the Bible doesn't tell us the details of what he did. I'm just going to give you a list of common things through human history that have made the difference in a man actually becoming loved and respected by his troops. And to the whatever extent we can say that these might have been the things that David did that endeared him to his own men, let alone the people. Number one, I would say composure on the battlefield. The ability not to panic under fire. Veteran soldiers will instantly notice the panic in a novice. So Saul could give him the office, send him out as the head of 1,000 soldiers. But if David shows himself to be afraid in the face of battle, the troops aren't going to respect him. David probably showed the same fearlessness as he did by going up against Goliath. What else likely were traits that he manifested? I would say tactical instincts. Tactical instincts that actually work. And obviously he was being helped by God with wisdom. But you're talking about a military exercise now in confronting enemies in different circumstances, different terrains, and different scenarios. And as the head, he's got to make a call on when they're going to fight and how they're going to fight, if they're going to fight. So he probably manifested tactical wisdom. And the men care about this, by the way. One of the best examples I know from reading history, including fictionalized history, if I'm going to read an author, it's going to be one, a fictional author, it's going to be one like Bernard Cornwell, who wrote like the Richard Sharp series, some of you might be familiar with it, concerning Napoleonic Wars. But it demonstrates a lot of these kind of characteristics that come out to distinguish one leader from another. What was the great weakness of the British militarily? They promoted the officers from the elite families who didn't have to have any credentials. All you had to do was have a title and your family would buy you a position as a colonel, or as a commissioned officer. And they had a bunch of idiots in those positions because they had no credibility militarily, and they certainly manifested no love or respect for the men. So who was it by comparison who would distinguish themselves and gain the love and the support of the army? It would be ones that showed ability under fire, that showed a military mind for picking the right time and means to engage in a battle, personal bravery with zero recklessness toward the men. There are some leaders who didn't care about the lives of the men. They treat them as cannon fodder, and they just send them out to be slaughtered. I'll bet you David was one of those who was respectful to conserve the lives of his men and did not do anything more than necessary to put them at risk. What else? David brought his respect for God. Can you imagine a commander who is showing by his own personal preference, not because he wants to preach at people, but literally his orientation was as a servant of God, trusting in God in faith. You don't think that would spread? Oh, yeah. And understand that these Israelites were pagan. I mean, they were mentally pagans. And yet, so they would have been steeped in their own superstitions, just like the Philistines and everybody else. Imagine someone like a young David coming along, showing by action his religion, his belief in God, his trust in God, and having that spread. That would have been different. What else? I suspect David believed in fair distribution of the plunder, of whatever they took after a battle, instead of taking it all to himself or his favorites. And care for the wounded, that's another biggie in the minds of the men. Showing respect for the soldiers, no man left behind. That'll get you a lot of points with the rank and file. What else? Willingness to listen to experienced officers. Even though he had the final say, and yet not say, no, I don't care about what you think, we're going to do it my way. To take counsel, there is wisdom in counsel. To pay attention to the experienced officers under him, but then being decisive to make decisions in the end. Veterans, by nature, hate both micromanaging aristocrats and officers who can't make a decision. David likely did neither. So, total speculation, but if it helps fill in to any extent the idea of what kind of attributes might have been manifested by young David, by God's special inspiration that gave him this reputation with the army as well as with the common people. Those are likely part of the story. All right, this is a good place to stop. Next time, we got basically halfway through chapter 18. We should get through, in the next installment, the rest of 18 and into chapter 19. We're going to find the escalation of Saul's scheming and offering David a wife next time.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the 18th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, December 13th, 2025.